G'day, humans. Welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. Steven Pinker. He might be one of the world's best-known cognitive psychologists, a public intellectual who for decades has used his fame to help us understand how we think, how we develop language, how our behaviour is shaped by evolution and biology. He is a professor of psychology at Harvard University. His most recent book is a hugely entertaining reflection on social norms, on cooperation, on outrage cycles and social media pile-ons, sudden political shifts, and moral panics. It's called When Everybody Knows That Everybody Knows. And Pinker joins me to discuss echo chambers and bank runs and media bias and why we hoarded toilet paper during COVID. I hope you enjoy as much as I did the one and only Steven Pinker. I think everyone is aware of the general contours of the problem of people being in echo chambers at the moment, Stephen. Part of the success of this show is its attempt to help people who would normally be in different bubbles of groupthink to understand what the hell the other one is talking about. What I think is really interesting in your new book is the fact of noticing that it isn't just the fact of the echo chamber that's a problem. It's also that everyone being on the same page that everybody is on the same page is the crucial sort of missing component. It's not enough for everybody to just be consuming the same worldview. They need to know that everybody else is also consuming the worldview for it to have currency. Why?
Because that state of knowing, common knowledge is the technical term, a little bit different than the way it's used in ordinary conversation, but common knowledge where everyone knows that everyone knows something. You know, I know it, something, you know it. I know that you know it, you know that I know it, I know that you know that I know it, and so on, is necessary for coordination, for people to be on the same page, for them all to join the same cause, for them to rendezvous, for them to respect societal conventions like paper currency or the words of a language. And so the state of knowing that everyone knows is a prerequisite to acting together. Now, it's very hard for us to wrap our minds around all these layers of I know that she knows and I know that she knows and so on. And we don't really have to think it through to that depth. If something is salient, if it's public, if it's self-evident, if it's visible in an arena in which I can see other people seeing it and they can see me seeing it, we can all see each other seeing it, that gives us the sense of common knowledge at a stroke. We don't have to think through all of the convoluted layers. We just know that the states of knowledge about knowledge are there as many layers as you would care to go down.
And your argument is that they basically need to be there for infinity in order for everything to hang together? Like, it's not just enough that I know that my neighbor knows that we both subscribe to the rule of law. My neighbor has to know that I know that my neighbor knows that I know that he knows that I know that he knows all the way down. What does that mean?
That knowledge, that knowledge it's implicit. That is, we obviously can't think in an infinite series of nested thoughts, but it's tucked into what we do appreciate, namely that something is self-evident, that it's seen in circumstances in which the seeing is seen. And then implicit, packed into that, is as many layers of I know that he knows that you may want to unfold. So another way of putting it is that we have reason to believe that everyone knows that everyone knows that everyone knows, even if we don't go through the bother of thinking that thought. In the same way that you know that right. that there are an infinite number of even numbers, even though you're not going to count them all out. You just know if anyone ever proposes that there's the largest one, you can add two to it and you get another one. And that
yes.
kind of gives you the tacit, implicit reason to believe that they're an infinite number, even if you don't actually work your way through the list. Yeah,
right. And so the argument of the book is essentially that a lot of what we take for granted in human civilization is hanging together on the principle of our assumption that we know that everybody else knows a certain thing. and that is currently being corroded? What is your concern?
Well, it is not being corroded across the board, because common knowledge is always relative to some group of knowers. There could be common knowledge between two people. There could be common knowledge in a group of friends or a group of onlookers. And there can be common knowledge through a group of, through an entire society. And what may be happening is that the networks of common knowledge are getting smaller than they were at their peak, when there was, say, a couple of national networks. In the U.S., they were the big three. In Britain, it was pretty much BBC. You could know that everyone was seeing the same thing that you were seeing, and that everyone knew that. Now, with cable news networks, with social media, the pools of common knowledge are fragmented. But it's more than that, because it's not just that you know what knowledge people are being exposed to, but you got to believe it. And the sources of credibility have multiplied and fractionated, so that we don't all trust the same sources of knowledge. So it used to be that if you pretty much heard it on national television, you'd believe it. You could have confidence that other people were believing it. Now some people know what's being said on national TV. It's not that they're ignorant of the fact that some guy said it. They just don't believe him. They have different sources of expertise, of credibility, of confidence, and the or in the case of, say, social media, there may be very little vetting or filtering at all. And rumors and urban legends and conspiracy theories propagate without people necessarily thinking, what is the credibility of the source? Is there good reason to believe that it's true? Not just that you hear it, you see it, but what goes into whether you believe it.
Yeah, you don't spend a lot of time on conspiracy theories in the book, but as you speak there, it is making me think that some of what gives energy to the counter narrative movement, you know, if we've gone from a world in which everybody knew what Walter Cronkite and Johnny Carson said, and they knew that everybody else knew it, and they knew it to be true, and they knew that everybody else knew that it was true, and they knew that everybody else knew that everybody else knew that it was true, to a world in which some significant minority of the population believes that most of what Joe Rogan says is true. And I'm not shitting on Joe here, he's a friend of mine, but you know, there's a lot of things that come out of his mouth that are not fact-checked. And they derive some of their confidence in their counter-narrative precisely from the fact that all of the normies believe, all of the sheeple believe this other thing. Then it's like, you know, there is a certain subset of I know that you know, which becomes clan-like or clique-like in opposition to the mainstream knowledge.
Yeah, so some of the traditional sources of authority have compromised themselves in aligning themselves too much with a political faction, particularly the left. That when you have scientists and public health officials and academics and trusted broadcasters just looking and sounding and feeling and smelling as if they're advocates for the political left, then that erodes their credibility. People just say, well, that's their tribe. I'm going to listen to the priests in my tribe. But also, in the best of times, it's not clear that how seriously people take their beliefs in realms beyond their immediate experience. So, you know, everyone's pretty much an empiricist. They believe in objective reality when it comes to whether there's petrol in the car, whether there's food in the fridge, whether the kids are dressed, because you have to be. Your reality is unforgiving, and unless you're logical and committed to the truth, you're going to, you know, run out of petrol. You're going to run out of food. The kids are going to be late to school. So reality is a firm check on your beliefs. And I think that, you know, that's why, by and large, people are pretty rational about their own lives. But when it comes to big academic and cosmic and abstract and ultimate questions, like what is the cause of fortune and misfortune and disease? What is the cause of economic crashes and bubbles? What really happens in the corridors of power? What really caused the Great Depression or World War II? There, you know, I think that probably people like you and me, and probably a lot of your listeners, think that there's an objective truth and there's a way to find it. We've got science, we've got historians, we've got data sets. But intuitively, that's not the way people work. People's kind of gut feeling is nobody knows and you can't find out. And so it's unclear what truth actually means in these big abstract cosmic realms. You may as well believe the most uplifting myth, the best story, the one that makes your side look good, that makes the other side look evil, the one that's good inspiration for the children, one that keeps the troops together. And the idea, well, is it actually objectively, factively true? Well, people who have absorbed the lessons of the scientific revolution and the Enlightenment feel that even in these big realms, there is truth, there is falsity, there are ways of determining which is which. But that's, you got to kind of sign on to the whole project of being part of universities, government record-keeping agencies, encyclopedias, and so on. Intuitively, people aren't necessarily plugged into that network, and they fall back on, I think, our default way of believing, which is for these big questions, the myth is as good as objective truth. There is no way to find out what the objective truth is.
Has that risen over the course of your lifetime, Stephen, that instinct? I mean, you're reminding me a little bit of Jordan Peterson in the sense that this is something that he will get tangled up in quite a lot, where he'll say, well, what? It depends what you mean by truth. What are we even talking about? You know, he'll be like, you know, if it's functional, then it is true, right? You know, Christianity is true by definition because it's so successful. And,
you know, I think people tend to backslide into that way of thinking. It's the natural way of belief. Those of us who think, no, you can't believe something just because it's taken over, it's powerful, it's compelling, it feels good, it gives your life meaning. The question is it true or not? Does the evidence support it? People who believe that are the weird ones in the sweep of human history. Now, I think it's very good to believe that. I think we are blessed with the scientific method and standards of journalistic editing and fact-checking and integrity and reputation and an adversarial process in the court system designed to uncover the truth and checks and balances in a democracy. All of these contraptions and gadgets and conventions that try to make more and more of human experience verifiable, a matter of truth and falsity. But it's always an uphill battle, and the natural tendency is to slip back down into subjectivity.
And what's your hunch, Stephen, about the sort of epistemology of this in terms of the people's desire to actually, well, I guess I'm asking about, like, how much do we actually believe the things that we say that we believe when they are abstract things rather than concrete things? Because Sam Harris will sometimes say that he's done studies when he was doing his PhD that show that religious belief is indistinguishable from literal beliefs, that when a person says that they believe that they're going to heaven, it's firing up the same parts of the brain as the one that is talking about how much petrol is in the car or how much, you know, when the kids have to go to school. I've always been skeptical of this, and am more so now that Donald Trump is in office, when people ask me whether or not I think that Donald Trump actually believes the things that he says that he believes, to which I have a hunch that he doesn't even, that it's not salient for him whether or not the number of people on the ground at the inauguration was more or less than what he claimed, or whether or not the number of ballots lodged in 2020 were more or less than he claimed. For him, I suspect that he has a more Jordan Peterson attitude towards truth, which is, it got me reelected. It functionally works. It might as well be true. It's as good as true. Who knows, really? We're never going to count all of the ballots. There's never going to be perfect knowledge of anything. Holding to this line is functionally true in the universe of the interests of Donald Trump, and therefore it's almost immaterial whether or not he does or doesn't believe the literal truth of the facts on the ground. How do you think our brains operate on that level? You
know, I think that is the way our brains operate, when it comes to realms outside of our immediate experience, our concrete surroundings, the cause and effect that govern our daily lives. Even there, you know, people can delude themselves, or people can be kind of squirrely about the facts. But I think there it's more likely that if you're lying, you know you're lying and you know that there is a truth. Whereas for anything at a larger scale, nationwide scale, anything you can actually see, I think that the Donald Trump, the postmodernist, postmodernist academics, pragmatists about truth, like Jordan Peterson, fall back on the idea that intuitively, how could anyone know? Now, and admittedly, it is unintuitive that you could know, that you can come to inferences based on, you know, on sampling, on extrapolation, on statistical algorithms. Yeah, I believe that is a way to ascertain what is true or false at the national scale, but I'm willing to concede that that this is not a natural way of thinking, that I've been immersed in a culture of truth seeking. That's kind of what science is. I believe with Bertrand Russell that it's undesirable to believe a proposition when there are no grounds for supposing it is true. But I also realize that that is an exotic, weird, unnatural state of belief. I think the more people that adopt it, the better. But it is an uphill battle. We've got to persuade people that that there are better and worse ways of being in touch with reality. We've been fortunate to have science and record keeping, and we ought to promote the use of that kind of falsificationist thinking in all realms of life, however unnatural it may feel.
Yeah, you're reminding me of Jonathan Rauch's excellent book, The Constitution of Knowledge, which you should read if you haven't.
Well, no,
that basically makes the argument.
It's actually the round. I did read it, and in fact, he is now he is cited, but he was up till this moment an uncited influence on the line of argument that I just gave you. At least
he is hereby officially a cited influence. Yeah, sorry.
But at least that he is one half of the story that I told in my book, my previous book, Rationality. The one half is simply that the natural mode of knowing when it comes to phenomena outside the realm of experience is a kind of postmodernist, mythological, non-factual way of thinking about it. The other half, and this is where Jonathan's book is so so important, is that those of us who've moved away from mythological thinking when it comes to big abstract realms do it only by benefit of institutions that have been contrived to seek the truth despite all these human biases. And what Jonathan pointed out is that in science, with its demands for empirical verification or falsification, in democracy with its checks and balances, in the judicial system with the adversarial parties, in Wikipedia with its pillars of sourcing and objectivity, in journalism with fact-checking and editing, all of these are unnatural institutions that have been cobbled together with the explicit goal of seeking the truth, with mechanisms that are workarounds for human cognitive biases. Without those workarounds, you're never going to get to the truth. And so you may as well believe in the most comforting myth. But since we do have those institutions, and of course, at any given time, they're all flawed and always constantly in need of repair and maintenance and reform. But it's good that we have them. We should strengthen them. We should rely on them more. We should try to persuade other people to rely on them more.
Yeah. And if people haven't read Jonathan's book, they can listen to him on this podcast.
Highly recommend it. It's excellent. He makes excellent points. Yeah.
And I think the main thrust of it that I took away from it is that there are, if you're a layperson, you aren't necessarily aware of the systems that exist in particular science and journalism to rectify human error. And that you can, it is always a bit of a canard or a red herring for people to say, well, but look at how biased the media was about this particular issue. Or look at how scientists got it wrong in the past. Scientists have been wrong about in the past, so maybe they're wrong about this now. That is true, but what you're overlooking is the fact that there are a bunch of systems that are in place where if you've worked in a scientific institution, which I haven't, but I have worked in journalistic organizations, people who haven't worked in a newsroom are not aware of the number of layers of fact-checking and editorial oversight that will over time conspire to yield a superior result to simply throwing our arms up in the air and saying, well, journalists make mistakes and scientists make mistakes, so therefore anything might be true.
Dead on. That's exactly right. And the thing is, none of us is infallible. None of us is omniscient. The New York Times has biases. Scientists have biases. But at least the New York Times recognizes that these are bad things, and scientists do or ought to. And they workarounds, reforms. They're willing, or at least should be willing, to show their work. This is something where I think some scientists and public officials have fallen short, especially in the time of an emergency like COVID pandemic. I think we would have all been better off if the experts acknowledged the error bars around their estimates, if they indicated how they came to their conclusions, if they acknowledged their own fallibilities, that when, as inevitably happens, they turn out to be wrong about something, they haven't forfeited all credibility, but have a self-healing, self-improving process that is fallible, because we're not angels. We don't have a pipeline to the truth. But on the other hand, Irving with his Twitter feed is not going to be any more accurate. He's pretty much guaranteed to be less accurate.
Who? The Holocaust denier, David Irving?
No, Irving was a randomly selected forename. It could have been Clyde.
Oh, could have been Clyde. Irving was just the funny name for the person.
It could have been Oscar. It could have been Melvin. It was just the first name.
Okay. Irving.
But no, not
Irving. Although that also fits in the context of the last 12 months of hand wringing about Tucker Carlson elevating.
But that was
Nick Fuentes.
If it was true, that was a coincidence. Yes.
Okay. There's another interesting, one of the interesting COVID anecdotes in the book relates to the toilet paper shortages, which you're just reminding me of, Stephen. Which you make a really interesting point, which is that the reason there was a run on toilet paper during COVID is not necessarily that there wasn't enough toilet paper to supply everybody, but it wasn't even that people were afraid that they would run out of toilet paper. It was that they were afraid that everybody else thought that there was not enough toilet paper, so everybody else would behave in that way. And that when supermarkets imposed a rule that you're only allowed to buy, one pack of toilet paper, the reason that succeeded was not so much because all of a sudden there was more toilet paper and people didn't hoard, but because everybody knew that everybody else knew that everybody else wouldn't be hoarding toilet paper. Yes. And there was therefore no need to.
Yes, toilet paper hoarding, it was a kind of a bank run on toilet paper. It was a self-fulfilling prophecy. Of course, if everyone started to hoard toilet paper, there really would be a shortage. It wasn't that the shortage caused the hoarding. It was the hoarding caused the shortage. And that was set off by cycles of, to use the fancy word, recursive mentalizing. Mentalizing means getting inside someone's head. Recursive mentalizing means getting inside someone's head while they're getting inside someone else's head, and so on. And so when you think about it, you think, well, if the rumor has gotten out that there's a shortage of toilet paper, it doesn't matter whether people believe there is or not. They're going to believe that other people believe the rumor, if only because they fear that other people will believe that still other people will believe the rumor, and that could cause the shortage. And therefore, I better go out and get some myself. According to one story, this all originated with a common knowledge generator of its time. In the United States, the talk show host, Johnny Carson, who hosted The Tonight Show, he was called the King of Late Night, and a good percentage of the American population would tune in every night. There were only three networks, and his was the show, the dominant show. And he, to the extent that catchphrases from the show, like, here's Johnny, were just recognized even by people who didn't watch the show. It was that famous. And in 1973, at a time when there were shortages of petroleum, of beef, of sugar, Carson made the quip, there are a lot of shortages these days, but have you heard the latest? I read it in the papers. There's a shortage of toilet paper. And in fact, there wasn't a shortage of toilet paper when he did that line, but soon there was, as people started panic buying. And according to that story, ever since then, whenever there is an emergency, like a hurricane or a blizzard, people think that toilet paper is the thing you got to hoard because other people think that it's the thing you have to hoard. Now, notice in the case of notice the back and forth here. This is a theme of my book between a salient public event, in this case, Johnny Carson making the quip and people being aware that he had a nationwide platform, and the thinking about thoughts about thoughts about thoughts. We go back and forth between one and the other, and it can generate nationwide phenomena, such as an actual toilet paper shortage. It's an idea that goes back to John Maynard Keynes, I think in the 1920s, the 1930s, where he commented on, he compared speculative investing, also subject to bubbles and crashes that are self-reinforcing, namely people buy a security because they think everyone else is going to want to buy it, and so the price will go up, so they hope to buy it now in the hope of selling it at a profit later.
Bitcoin.
Bitcoin, yes. And not coincidentally, Bitcoin was touted in viral ads in the American Super Bowl, another common knowledge generator.
Yeah, Larry David ad,
the Matt Damon ad, where they said nothing about the advantages of Bitcoin, like you can buy weapons with it, you can buy drugs, you can buy hookers, and the government can't confiscate it. Nothing like that was even mentioned. It was, don't miss out. Other people are buying it. Buy it now, so in the hope that you will be able to unload it in the future at a profit to, as they say in investing, a greater fool. Now, the idea, the way Keynes analyzed speculative investing was he imagined a beauty contest. I think he even said that there was such a beauty contest in the British papers of his day. I don't think it's ever been confirmed. But the object of this contest is not to pick the prettiest face. It's to pick the face that the most other contestants pick, knowing that the other contestants are picking a face by the same criterion.
Right, not the ones that they find. So everybody is trying to second guess what everybody else thinks is the prettiest face.
Exactly. And he noted that that can result in kind of cycles of people trying to outguess each other. And he compared that to many economic phenomena, speculative bubbles and pops of speculative bubbles, but also even confidence in the economy that can result in depressions. Depressions used to be called panics because firms would not hire out of fear that no one would buy their products. People wouldn't buy anything out of fear they might lose their jobs. So it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. People in real bank runs would dash to the banks to withdraw their savings, which meant pretty quickly the banks could not redeem further withdrawals. And so when in the depths of the Depression, Roosevelt said, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. That was literally true. It was the fear of other people's fear that generated and kept the country in a depression.
Mm.
And indeed,
and in fact, you make the point in the book that the one reason why banks look so lavish and opulent, why, you know, the nicest building in any town is often the bank, is the bank proving to everybody, look how rich we are. You don't have to take your money out. We've got all this, look at us.
The marble columns, the gilt lettering, the massive lobbies. Yes, we're ready to say we've got not only are we telling you that we have assets to fall back on, but you are now seeing that everyone else sees that the bank has assets, and it was meant to tamp down these self-fulfilling panics. Now, of course, obviously it worked only so well because, you know, despite that, we did have a Great Depression. And that's why, at least in the United States, and I believe, I'm guessing this is true in Australia as well, that there is federal deposit insurance that up to a certain amount, if your bank goes under, the federal government will be a lender of last resort, will bail you out. And the thing is that the reason that's such a good deal is the government never does have to bail out a bank, or very rarely, because the fact that the government is willing to bail them out means that they won't have to, because there won't be self-fulfulling bank runs. Well, of course, that can be exploited, where you can have, if there is an expectation that the government will bail out risky behavior, that can lead to what they call a moral hazard, where companies and investors will take crazy risks knowing that the government will be there to bail them out. And that's one explanation of the financial crisis of 2008, that it was a house of cards with finance companies knowing that they were, as they say, too big to fail, and that a safeguard against the kind of self-fulfilling panics could itself cause one if people exploited it.
Interestingly, the Australian Federal Bank Deposit Insurance was only introduced during the relatively recent financial crisis and had been resisted, you know, in 2008, 2009. It had been resisted prior to that for that reason, for the moral hazard reason. But eventually it was bad enough that the government relented. You're also reminding me that during the Eurozone crisis, when it looked like Greece might crash out of the euro, it was the thing that markets were waiting for, according to my friend who was writing for the Wall Street Journal at the time and knew this better than anyone, was just for the head of the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi, I think his name was, and the Chancellor of Germany to say that they will do whatever it takes to keep the euro together, meaning the subtext being we'll give Greece whatever money it needs in order for it not to crash out of the eurozone. And simply saying the words, we'll do whatever it takes, was the moment at which everything turned. And then you don't have to do everything because everybody knows that everybody else knows that Greece is still a good bet.
Indeed.
Right.
And that's why the sayings of financial leaders can be so influential, and why they often have to wordsmith their remarks, sometimes to the point of comedy. I cite a famous quotation by Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve in the United States for many years, that since I've become a central banker, I've learned to mumble with great incoherence. If I seem clear to you, you must have misunderstood what I said. Because people hang on their words because they're signals that other people are hanging on. I also cite one of his predecessors, an economist named Alfred Kahn, who was the inflation czar of Jimmy Carter. And Carter told him never to use the word depression because it could be self-fulfilling. And at one point he said, I know I'm not supposed to say certain words, but you know, we're in danger of having the biggest banana in 40 years.
I love it. Stephen, I don't know if you've seen the new Naked Gun movie, just as an aside, but on the question of crypto being a Ponzi scheme, essentially, one of the big stadiums in the United States is sponsored by Binance or one of the crypto companies, is it right? And Seth MacFarlane has the main sports stadium in Naked Gun, is entitled PonziScheme.com Stadium, which I thought was...
I haven't seen it yet.
It was cute,
but I saw the first two, and
it's pretty good. It's pretty good.
Okay,
it's as good as you can expect a remake to be. One of the interesting things that I've been thinking about since reading the book, Stephen, is authority, is how we telegraph authority to each other, especially in multi-ethnic and multicultural societies, because you talk about how a boss or a leader or a general will often festoon themselves with big hats and robes, and they'll, you know, the elevated platforms, they'll have the corner office, they'll have giant statues, they'll have bigger planes, they'll have ways of trying to telegraph to everybody that everybody knows that everybody knows that this person deserves your fealty. And the reason why it works is because there's a common knowledge that they expect subordinates to give way, and the subordinates expect the big person to stand his ground. And as long as everybody is on the same page about that, that works.
It works to a point.
However, jump in there. I just wanted to complicate that with some observations of mine.
Proceed. Yes, go ahead.
Well, so yesterday I was at a water park here in Australia with my kids, you know, big water slide, gigantic water slides, a theme park. And there were a couple of young white Aussie lads, probably 15 or 16, who were being sort of larrikin-ish behind an Arab Muslim couple, and she was wearing her like hijab, and they had a younger daughter there, and the man was quite aggressive towards these guys, right? And they I think just accidentally bumped into him, and he turned around and did the big I'm a big bear type act. And he was like, you know, you guys want to make something of it? You want to make something of it? You know, puffing his chest out, kind of coming towards them, the alpha gorilla, and was and really got sufficiently threatening that it was almost at the point where I wanted to step in and defend them. Everyone's on edge in Sydney anyway. We had a terrorist attack a week ago. You know, relations between maybe he's feeling besieged and he's been subject to racism in the wake of the jihadist attack or something. I don't know. But I was reminded of your book because I thought the way that he is asserting his dominance, he thinks that it's understood by them as a legitimate way for masculine authority to be exercised. But in my common knowledge, he's pulling off a shitty move. And he's actually in the wrong by being so overtly threatening, because we would have a more conciliatory, in Anglo-Saxon culture, we'd have a more conciliatory way of trying to get the people to stop bumping into us and acting out. So what do you make of it when you've got sort of different networks of different common knowledge all living together and having to essentially translate on the fly as to what the intention of the other party is?
Yeah, and well, of course, there's a difference between what we ought to do and how, in reality, human social relationships actually work. And so sometimes there are things that are very effective even though we can deplore that they work that way. So yes, in the case of dominance, dominance can be self-fulfilling in the sense that if there is cost to a conflict, if they come to blows, then both parties are better off. It's certainly best of all to be the dominant and to enjoy the perks of dominance without the cost of a fight. For the subordinate, it kind of sucks to be the subordinate, but it might suck even worse to be in a fight, especially if chances are the other guy will win the fight. But whether or not he wins, you can both be bloodied. So that's why many animals and probably humans settle into dominance hierarchies based on common knowledge of who will stand his ground because they can expect the other one to give in and who will give in because they expect the other one to stand his ground. That is signaled by something, a common knowledge generator, something that is visible to both. And the most natural ones, since they correlate with fighting ability, are signs of strength and size. And here we've culturally mimicked what many animals have evolved, such as a lion with its mane, a gorilla with its sheer bulk, orangutans with where the alpha male actually grows these preposterous cheek pouches. Sometimes they really do indicate probability of prevailing in fisticuffs. Sometimes they're just correlate that with they're just big and they just start our signals. Well, someone's got to back down. Someone's got to predominate. It'll be the one that has the fancy ornament that everyone recognizes. Now, that doesn't necessarily last forever. The person or baboon getting the short end of the stick can leave and just not engage with that with the dominant indefinitely. And in a relationship such as a marriage, that's often what does lead one person to leave, where they just are locked into a relationship where they're doing all the giving and the other person is doing all the taking. It can sometimes result in blows. It can come to blows when the one getting the short end of the stick realizes that it's actually they're no worse off if actually joining the fight than always accepting crumbs thereafter. So if the cost of if the subordinate judges that the cost of fighting is not higher than the cost of submitting, then there may very well be a fight. Or it could be done collectively, even in cases where the subordinate will lose a one-on-one fight. If they feel they have safety in numbers, then they can strike back, knowing that they've got a posse of comrades, of brothers in arms. That's why in another phenomenon that I write about, the communal outrage, an incident in which a member of your group is conspicuously attacked in a public arena, can lead to a lashing out, a sudden disproportionate rage where people in the group that they feel has been, whose member has been victimized, can suddenly coordinate, use that common knowledge insult or affront as an invitation to try to upend the dominance hierarchy and collectively assert their own dominance. Now, you get that repeatedly in history when some event that would seem to be relatively minor, or at least something that a blow that one could absorb, in fact, triggers a massive collective retaliation. And I go through many examples. The Spanish-American War, which led to the pretty much the end of Spanish colonies and the United States taking over Cuba and Philippines and so on, was triggered by the sinking of a ship, the Maine, leading to the slogan, "Remember the Maine." May even have been misattributed, not sabotage by the Spanish, but just an accident, but that didn't much matter. Pearl Harbor in World War II got the United States to finally join the war. 9/11 led to the invasions of Iran and Afghanistan. The Arab Spring was set off by a Iraq food peddler. In the United States, actually worldwide, the events of 2020 of the Great Awakening, and in the United States, many demonstrations and riots, some of them violent, set off by the killing of George Floyd. Then in the other direction, the assassination of Charlie Kirk in the United States a couple of months ago was taken as a communal outrage by the American right, who used that to spread the sense that they had been symbolically victimized in that event, but collectively victimized for many years by the liberal establishment, and use that as a opportunity to lash out at anyone who didn't treat the assassination with a sufficient awe and dread and gravity.
I mean, it feels like in those cases, you've got the manufacturing of common knowledge, right? I mean, in some ways, the hysteria of the social justice left during wokeness and the hysteria of the right after Charlie Kirk almost seemed like an attempt to enforce a new consensus in the absence of a genuine consensus.
Well, yes, but that itself was already was common knowledge, which allowed for the coordination with these manufactured agendas or grievances, such as in the case of Charlie Kirk killing, where not only was it misattributed to some kind of left-wing conspiracy, but it was seen as emblematic of a widespread persecution of the right by the liberalist.
Yes.
And yes, that was...
And the narrative that Democrats are the Democrats are the party of murder and the left is the party of violence.
Yes. But the thing is that the trigger for it, the spark, was something that was common knowledge, namely the killing was widely reported. Any assassination will attract outsized attention. And moreover, the attention is something that you are itself aware of. You know that as you're reading about the Charlie Kirk killing, so is everyone else. And so it is.
Yes.
The common knowledge is generated simply by the fact that it's public and salient and dramatic and unignorable. Then that could be put to use in service of a manufactured agenda.
Yeah, I see. Yes, that's absolutely true. And obviously, in moments after a tragedy, everybody is groping around. Some people are groping around for the truth, and others are groping around for ways in which they can try to assert their narrative, their version, in which the instance of common knowledge can be used as a way of vindicating beliefs in the first place.
Exactly. The fact that a police officer smothered a suspect in Minneapolis is not obviously related to the fact that there is an underrepresentation of African Americans in symphony orchestras or art museum boards. Nonetheless, it was the killing of George Floyd was taken to be emblematic of systemic racism, of which underrepresentation of African Americans was framed as another manifestation. And the right wing equivalent in the case of Billy Kirk.
Yes, I recently wrote a piece for the broadsheet newspaper here a week after the terrorist attack, which began with a paragraph summarizing one sentence each of the ways in which all of the different factions in Australia are trying to co-opt it in order to, as evidence of, you know, the left says it proves this, the right says it proves this, Jews say it proves this, you know, non-Jews say it proves this, and to a plea for us all to just calm down for a moment and find some common ground. One of the interesting, I mean, you answered half of my question, which I think was kind of muddied in the sense that we've talked about the dominance and submission signals inside common knowledge. But I'm still intrigued by where you think we find ourselves. I guess I'm particularly thinking about this now in the case of multiculturalism and jihadism and anti-Semitism and so on, because when there are groups with different levels of common knowledge. You know, even take, for example, the Australian government is contemplating banning the phrase globalize the intifada from being chanted in public. We don't have a First Amendment, so hate speech laws can cover that sort of thing. Half the country thinks that it's an innocent expression of Palestinian liberation and self-determination. Half the country thinks that it's an implicit way of saying that all the Jews in the Middle East should be driven out or killed. There are two camps of common knowledge here. Neither of them can understand the other. Are you optimistic about the capacity to find our way through these increasingly uncommon knowledge spheres?
I don't know if I'd say I'm optimistic. It's very hard to predict what will happen. You know, I think there is an imperative, a moral and normative imperative of what we ought to do, namely to explore the historic origins and the likely effects of particular expressions and to argue against them. I'm a fellow member of the Commonwealth. I was born in Canada, but my adopted country is the United States, and I think that the American attitude toward free speech is the more defensible one. Namely, I don't think it should be outlawed, but I think that people should come down on it like a type of bricks and saying what globalize the intifada means is mass murder. Literally and in effect, you just saw it. And I think it is perfectly appropriate to try to shame people who use the expression, either innocent or duplicitous about both what it literally means and how it could be taken, and to condemn it publicly. The First Amendment doesn't protect an expression against being condemned. All it does is it protects the people against the government punishing someone for using it, but it absolutely should be condemned.
I want you to put on your linguist hat for a moment. One of the most interesting things in the book is sort of buried in chapter 3, where you say that language, which you've spent your life studying, has 1,000 explanations for why it came to be. You know, a lot of people disagree about why language arose. And your explanation is that first and foremost, it's a tool for establishing common knowledge, which makes me wonder what you make of seemingly nonsensical forms of language. If language is an agreement that we're hardwired to understand so that others can understand it, what do you make of something like 6-7, which my 8-year-old son says and has no idea what it means?
Yes. Well, it's language to be a coordinating medium needn't be through the literal meaning of words. It could just be what they signify in terms of who recognizes them, who acts on them. Very often, our words are not meant to be taken literally. And I have a whole chapter on that called Weasel Words. But the mere act of uttering something can signal something about the social circle that we belong to, or that we want to convey that you and I belong to, independent of the literal content. And so I think the idea that language is a common knowledge generator is compatible with the fact that it often doesn't have that function by virtue of what words mean, although it very often does. If it's two people arranging for a rendezvous, they ought to attend to the literal meaning of it. Anytime two people divide up a task or make a plan, they're taking advantage of language's ability to do that. But sometimes it's words can be formulas that generate common knowledge, just like signals like hats and feathers and so on, and can have that function in a parallel channel to the semantics of what's being said. That's why in, say, cementing a romantic relationship, the fixed expression, I love you, then the I love you return, the reciprocation, is a ritual that can mark the transition between friendship or acquaintanceship and a deep romantic relationship, which is why the words are often fraught. Actually, a while ago, a woman said to me, I love you, but not in a scary way. That is. and not in this, by which what she meant is, you know, I just, you know, there's a lot of affection between us. I really, you know, deeply admire or cherish you, but I'm actually not using the word in the ritualistic sense that often accompanies saying those three words.
Yes. Do you remember a scene in, there's a romance with Jack Nicholson and is it Diane Keaton from maybe 15 years ago? And I may be misremembering this, but they're falling in love and they're older, you know, single people. And she says something funny and he says, ah, I love you. And she looks at him and says, I love you too. And the way he said, I love you, was just a little not that, you know, it was like, he sort of said it, but he didn't quite say it. And it was a nice moment where you realize there's a difference between a throwaway, I love ya, and I love you.
No, absolutely. I forgot about that scene, but there is a New Yorker cartoon that works on the same difference where a man says to a woman, I didn't say I love you, I said I love ya. Big difference. But anyway, same.
Okay, that's it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
that's
exactly
it. That's the gag.
Exactly the same. Yes.
When my kids say "I love you," I sometimes wonder what the evolution of the meaning of words is as children grow up. Because one of the first things that they said after "Daddy" would have been "I love you," because we were saying it a lot, and you know they mimicked it. So before they had a grasp of what we think that the phrase means, they were saying it. Now that they're 8, they know what it means, and I think their understanding probably aligns roughly with mine. But how do children develop? What is your theory about how richly and how early children develop an understanding that aligns with what we would understand our understanding to be?
Yeah. Well, we also seeing a cultural transition where it used to be in my generation, a parent or a child would say, I love you, you know, on the parent's deathbed, and that would be pretty much it. Not because there was any...
Right, yeah.
Lost love, but this is like a very, you know, solemn, momentous thing to say. Now it's thrown around hi, how are you?
Totally, like saying hello, yeah.
So I think kids, so this is something I've given a lot of thought to because I've written several books on language and language development in children. So what children do when they're acquiring language is they're not just pure cryptographers, they're not like ChatGPT processing the co-occurrence of one word with another word. They hear language in context and they try to relate the words they hear to their best guess as to the intention of the speaker. That is, they are engaging in, again, to use the word mentalizing or mind reading, getting inside the head of another person and then connecting that to what they said. And that can occur at multiple levels, at the level of the entire expression in that emotional circumstance, or they can parse it into particular words and a salient object or a salient action in that circumstance. They're doing it at multiple levels from word to utterance. Now, and a bit of evidence that this mind reading is essential to language acquisition is that in a population that primary symptom is an inability to get into someone's head, namely autism, profoundly autistic kids never learn to speak. And I suspect that isn't a deficit in whatever circuitry there is for language, but a deficit in the circuitry for getting inside someone else's head. So the noises coming out of their mouths, you don't think of as expressing an intention, in particular, an intention to recognize that the intention of what they're actually saying. If that whole psychological process mind reading process is disabled, then the child can't make it to first base when it comes to figuring out how language works.
Right. Fascinating. Yeah. And so do you have a guess at the age at which children, at which developmentally normal children develop, I guess, the richness of the words that take it from mimicry to meaning?
Well, if anything, some of the first things that kids learn are expressions like bye-bye and hi and look, which don't necessarily have to be parsed in terms of their syntax or even the meaning looked up, but they're just used in they're the formulas that you say in that context. You know, like hi, doggy, bye bye, no. In some cases, kids will use a formula that they don't really understand and only later start to chop it into words, each of which has its own meaning.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's certainly the way that I love you began, right? It was a thing that kids said, that my kids said when they were 2 years old, because that was the thing that, you know, they got a good response when they mimicked that one. But now when my son feels that I'm being especially tender to him, he'll look me in the eyes and say, I love you. And that's different. I'm just wondering how long that takes to evolve and when that happens.
Oh, you mean in the course of childhood? I think a lot would depend on how it's used in the family. You know, again, you know, when I was growing up, the answer would be, you know, never. But, you know, there's right. plenty of affecting. It wasn't that we were, you know, cold robots. It's just not the thing you would say.
Yeah.
And I imagine in different subcultures, there would be a lot of variation in whether an expression like that, which could be so fraught, could be so scary, is kind of brought into everyday social interactions. You know, that's a historical change that we are living through. And I'd be willing to bet that it's very uneven across families and across subcultures.
Are there things that you're noticing about how university students speak that catch your ear, or just new forms of vernacular? I mean, I mentioned 6-7. So what you never quite got to 6-7. What is that? When you say that not all words literally mean the thing that they mean, I understand that, and you've got a whole chapter on euphemisms and weasel words in the book. But for something to drop out of the sky, seemingly unconnected to any meaning, is it serving as a tribal, just a marker of, like, I can do this to show that I'm the type of person who says this thing?
Language is filled with things like that that can be markers of solidarity and a deeper connection. Languages, I mean, certainly all of the reflexes of politeness are there to establish certain relationships. That is, I am not treating you like an underling or a flunky, or mixed up with the hierarchical signals that language conveys. There's also a kind of horizontal dimension of closeness, solidarity, equality. And in languages that have a distinction between two second person pronouns, tu and vous in French, or English used to have thou and you, German, du and si, the meaning is actually two different meanings. You say in French, you would use vous either for respect, like a student addressing a teacher, or in two strangers.
Or plural.
Or plural. Yes, that's actually a third meaning. But, or actually, I should say, better put, is that in these distinctions are not made in the plural, and vous is used without distinction.
Yes, right.
For either familiarity or respect. But one can also, so So that to is used either for looking down on someone or familiarity, that is, within a family. And in a social change that's been going on for more than a century toward informalization, egalitarianism, leveling of hierarchies, the to vu distinction is used less and less for hierarchy and more for intimacy versus distance. So it used to be, for example, that at a department store, say a customer could address a sales clerk with to on first meeting because they were lower in status. More and more, they would address them with vu simply because they are strangers until they become more intimate. Analogy in English is first name basis, addressing someone on a first name basis as opposed to Mr. or Miss or Mrs. So-and-so, where it used to be that Mr. would be used either for someone who is superior to you, whereas the boss would address the employee just by his last name, or by strangers on first meeting. But more and more, Mr. would be used for more distant, less intimate acquaintances, and even across the board, giving way to a first name basis. So this is the phenomenon of informalization, which has affects our dress, affects our styles of speech, and it's another example of how language operates on the channel of serving as a conduit for information, but also its surface forms, the words that we choose in parallel, signal the relationship we have with someone else.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And of course, there are different common knowledge assumptions in different communities. I was recently I stepped on board a Qantas flight, the Australian airline, and it was in business class. And the flight attendant came over to greet me and said, "Do you mind if I call you Josh?" And I thought, there is no Asian airline and probably not very many European airlines where the flight attendant in business or first class would not just address you as Mr. Zeps and, you know, would have the audacity to ask. But in Australian culture, that's nice. Like the flight attendant is doing that, and I quite like it as a way of saying, let's just be more relaxed here. It's going to be nice. You know, it's yes. you're part of the family of this team.
Well, indeed, and cultures do differ. Australia being proud of its informality and egalitarianism, Japan having far more formulaic and ritualistic honorifics and class distinctions.
Yes.
But the world in general is sort of heading, you know, Australia word. That is that many of the trappings of social hierarchy are either eroding altogether, or this two dimensions of hierarchical rank and horizontal closeness are collapsing to mere horizontal closeness. Notice that even in that case, she asked your permission. She didn't just blurt it out.
That's true. Yes. How do you feel? Are you the old guy waving his fist at the sky when you see people getting on an airplane wearing sweatpants, or, you know, some people just being very casual with each other in broader life? Is there a place for hierarchy and formality more than we currently have?
Yeah, I think something is lost, and maybe it's just, you know, like all generations, as I age and see social change going on out from under me, I lament what we lost. But it was just a more pleasant experience in the days when people would dress up to board a flight. When there was less profanity and casual speech, when people would save a taboo word for a moment of high emphasis or emotion, that's just aesthetically, I think something is lost when we sacrifice a distinction that was there. I also wonder, and here this is pure speculation, whether the fact that men tend to dress the same way they dressed when they were 3 years old and their mother would dress them. that is the baseball cap. Well, now it's backwards, and the t-shirt and the shorts and the sneakers, the running shoes. If there are no more signifiers of coming of age, we're not the right gender to ask, but you kind of wonder whether women are kind of less attracted to a male specimen who is announcing, "I have never grown up. I'm still a little boy."
And of course, there's a whole, I mean, we could open a whole can of worms there about the common knowledge assumptions that have now been established within certain communities. I'm thinking of the tech community in Silicon Valley, for example, where there are overt signifiers of status that are related to the informality and even cheapness of the attire.
Yes, like Mark Zuckerberg with his famous hoodie uniform.
Yeah, it's a hoodie or a black T-shirt or something, you know, just sneakers. If you would wear a suit, if you wore a beautiful $5,000 Armani suit to a meeting in Silicon Valley, they'd look down on you. That would be a marker of low status.
Well, even if you bought a $200 suit at TJ Maxx, and so you weren't flaunting wealth, but you were signaling formality. That itself would be negative enough. I think that there's got to be a mix. You don't want to go back to the stuffy high society formalities where a woman couldn't wear a dress, a man couldn't go out without a necktie and a hat. On the other hand, preserving some of the distinctions that just differentiate situations that have some aesthetic value, I think is worth attending to, even if we don't turn the clock back, which we can't.
I used to describe my grandfather as the kind of guy who'd put on a tie to get on a plane, and people immediately understood the kind of person that I'm talking about.
My grandparents, who are a generation older than your grandparents, would address their closest friends as Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so. Around the dinner, Mr. So-and-so, would you pass the salt? And that's just the way that people addressed each other, even the level of intimacy of close friendship. So it's inexorable process that the direction is clear, but at what level you make the cuts. Above that level, you use an honorific. Below that level, a first name basis. That varies a lot between different cultures and subcultures.
Yeah, you're actually reminding me that I was briefly, we moved to a different city when I was 10, and I was briefly put in a hippy-dippy primary school where the students addressed the teachers by their first name.
Yes, right.
Which was wild to me, right? You know, and similarly, I had a friend of mine who would come over to my house and address my parents as Mr. and Mrs. Zepps, which was the opposite, but also equally weird, because all of my friends when we were kids would call the parents by their first names because our parents wanted informality, but the teachers didn't. Before I let you go, Stephen, finish that thought.
I'll just share a way in which these conventions are so widely understood by a socially competent member of a society or subculture. But I've been a professor now for 45 years. And with virtually no exceptions, undergraduates will address me as Professor Pinker, graduate students on a first name basis. It's just I've never heard anyone articulate that convention, but that's the way it works, to the point where when I had a graduate student who kept addressing me as Professor Pinker, she was from Europe, from Austria, perhaps, and presumably that's the way it's done there. But it felt a little awkward, and I had to tell her, please call me Steve. Although with undergraduates, it's still the convention, unless the hierarchy gives way to the social closeness. If they say work in my lab, if they have lab parties together, then there can be a transition. Although it's still marked with some degree of nervousness of switching from professor to Steve.
But it's so interesting, isn't it? We do have an emotional flare up when that happens. I used to work for the public broadcaster, and so as the voice of sort of officialdom, if I was interviewing a prime minister or a minister, I would address them as prime minister or minister. And now that I do a podcast, I recently had a former prime minister on my podcast, and I was calling him Tony. And it's very weird once you've been trained to expect to call the person prime minister to call them Tony. It feels like I'm big-noting myself.
Yes, indeed. Yes, and all these emotions, the emotions of awkwardness when it's mild and shame on one side or outrage on the other are the emotions that police these relational models. What kind of relationship of hierarchy, intimacy, transactional nature we have. And in the book, I talk a lot about how navigating, switching among those different, qualitatively different kinds of relationships drives a lot of our social life, our social rituals, and our social emotions like awkwardness and shame.
Mm. It's getting late where you are, so I want to let you go. But I just lastly, can I ask you one last question about meaning and just get your thoughts about whether the future is going to be okay and human beings will find meaning in this crazy world? Because a lot of your work in the past has had to do with human well-being and human flourishing and arguing that things are getting better, even though we might not be noticing the ways in which they are. And yet I can't help but find myself worrying about right-wing Christian nationalism in America and the far right in Europe and far left anti-tech environmentalism and a kind of a general diagnosis that the humankind's problems are caused by a lack of spiritual fulfillment, a lack of purpose, and a lack of meaning. As a non-religious, scientifically minded person, as we were saying at the beginning of the chat, what's your remedy?
Well, certainly keeping an eye on what is truly meaningful in the sense that you could defend it, you could provide reasons for it. And human well-being, solving of problems is foremost because everyone can be better off or worse off. Everyone wants to be healthy and well-fed and affluent and comfortable and educated and socially close. What we wish for ourselves, we can't deny others. There's plenty of opportunities for making other people better off. There are inevitably problems, hard problems. Solving those problems is what ought to give life meaning. It can give life meaning to those who succeed in solving problems, and it ought to give meaning in that we can provide reasons why it should be the source of our meaning. And that's why, as compared to, say, following religious commandments or observing rituals, however good that they may feel, and you know, that itself is a good, but it isn't ultimately not as important as actually saving lives, extending life, spreading knowledge, reducing suffering.
Professor Pinker, or Steve, depending on the casualness of our relationship. Thanks for being on Uncomfortable Conversation.
Thanks for having me.